All right, welcome in to the next episode of The Hours. I'm joined by Tyler, and we are going to jump into the big question, one that I'm very intrigued by. But before we do that, Tyler, small question. Have you paid attention to USA basketball so far?
Not as much as I would have liked, but I do know scores and some highlights.
Okay. I was up last night thinking about this, and I was questioning my basketball intelligence because before these exhibition games started, I was on record saying this team is the greatest team ever assembled and would beat the Dream Team by 20 to 25. And I don't know that I'm wrong. They haven't proved me right yet, but I would say this. I'm a little concerned for USA basketball right now, just winning the gold. But if we look at the Dream Team, obviously great collection of talent. The teams that they were playing against versus the team that the 2024 team is playing against, completely different. You know, Dream Team is signing autographs after their games. They probably won a lot of games before the ball was tipped up. I don't know how many teams are intimidated by the USA team now. So my small question to you, should I be concerned about USA basketball winning the gold?
Yes.
Okay.
And I mean, three additional thoughts. You hit on many of these. One, this team would absolutely crush the Dream Team in head-to-head competition. So I believe that is true. I think two, there is way more parity in the league and more talent internationally at that time. You know, basketball in the U.S. was far ahead of that in the rest of the world. But the rest of the world, I think, has caught up. We've seen that with, you know, Jokic and Doncic and Giannis and, you know, top players in the world being, you know, overseas talent. I mean, think back to the Dream Team. There was a bare handful of overseas players in the NBA, and they were almost like a novelty. Like, wow, this European player is actually getting playing time is pretty good. What a shock. Right. And then I think the last thing is the game is more volatile now than it was, just the style of play with so many more threes, so much more transition. You know, the way that the game was played when the Dream Team was playing, I don't think that there was as much variance as there is now. There's massive variance now because people understand the analytics.
Yeah, agree. I think the different styles is definitely highlighted. I see like the USA team trying to draw fouls, and it's not really a thing in international basketball as much as it is here, which I'm not a fan of. The, you know, offense is trying to score, not try to draw a foul. So yeah. I think if you're trying to score, getting fouled is a byproduct of that. Yeah. So I guess all that does make sense. When I was thinking USA basketball, I started thinking about this, which is going to lead us to the big question. Interested to hear your thoughts. I'll ask it this way. Take it or leave it, the Elam ending.
Take it all the way to the house.
Okay.
So I would love for all rules everywhere at all levels to be aligned. I was having a conversation with a referee this last weekend. He's like trying to stump me with basketball rules. And he's like, well, then the NFHS high school, this is the rule. It's like, well, we can argue about rules all the time. And like a ref's like, oh, the guy, it's a foul on the ground according to high school rules. You're thinking, you know, you're thinking college rules. And it's like, who determines what rule set we're playing by at what time? Yeah, it was just frustrating. And so that's first off, I would love just all rules to be aligned. That'd be great. And second, Elam ending is the way basketball should be played. Because it just increases excitement. So for those of you that aren't aware, here's Elam ending. The concept is you play to a target score instead of until time runs out. And traditionally, you would just replace the fourth quarter with a target score as opposed to a clock. And you would predetermine an amount of points that you would add to the team that is leading as the target score. So if a team's up 50 to 40 and you have chosen to add 20 points as a target score, then you're playing to 70 points. and, you know, Mark's team's up 50-40 and we're playing it to 70 points. Obviously, you would want to have an average quarter score for the level that you're playing to establish that ELAM ending. But I think the three benefits are, one, you always end on a walk-off. Like, someone's hitting a game winner. That's exciting. People get pumped about that. Two, when you're going to target score, you're going to eliminate all of the stops of the clock at the end with the intentional fouling by the losing team. Nobody wants to see someone shoot free throws. You don't pay money for that. That's not fun for anybody at all. And then I think the third thing with the ELAM ending is, I think it gives a chance for the losing team, a better chance for the losing team or the underdog team to actually make a run, which is what people like. They like close games. You're going to get more close games with an ELAM ending. So I think it's all good.
Agreed. And I'll echo the game winner. I think it'd be awesome just you have a game winner on every single game. I think another benefit would be you get rid of stall ball. You talked about getting rid of like the fouls into the game. Baseball has sped up the game with the pitch clock. I think the end of basketball games can be brutal at times with all the fouls, all the timeouts, and basketball has made some rule changes to get rid of that. This ending would get rid of all that by default. I'll also add, I got two more. It's the way we practice. Typically at practice, we are playing to a certain amount of points. We're playing 5-on-5 to 5 by ones and twos. I like playing to 8 by twos and threes because it's really quick games. They last about 5 minutes, and you can't take a possession off when you're playing by twos and threes to 8. So it's the way we're really accustomed to training. And then I'll add this. At the high school level, the big debate right now is the shot clock. There is no incentive to stall or hold the ball with a lead if you have to get to a certain amount of points. At least I think it eliminates that. Now, I'm in line with you. I would still be on board with a shot clock at all levels, and I think that shot clock should be 24 seconds at all times, at all levels, even youth level. I think we're the only ones that don't do that. So yeah, I'm all in favor. I would love to see the Olympics played in that with the ELAM ending and that structure, but I do think the G League adopted it for overtime. Yeah,
and then the NBA All-Star game as well.
Yeah, I don't think they do that this past year, or was that just 1 year?
Well, I can't tell you what they did this past year because I didn't watch the All-Star game this past year because it's atrocious basketball. But I know they did in years past.
Yep. I love it for
There's no way to save the NBA All-Star game. Like, they've been trying to save the All-Star game for years. There's no way to save it at all.
Yeah. They tried to do the draft. I agree. I think All-Star games and home run derbies and all that stuff is kind of going by the wayside a little bit. Yeah, and I think the way to drip it in would be just to adopt it for all overtimes. I think that'd be a great way to like the G League did, and that's where we're going to start. And then I would love to see in the future, but change comes slow, as we know. So if you disagree with our take on the Dream Team versus this year's team or the ELAM ending, let us know. Great place to do that is in our school community. Have over 600 members in our community now, constant engagement in there. If you're listening and you're not in there, we'd encourage you to join in the community and join in the engagement. All really, really good stuff in there.
I mean, I would love to hear an argument as to how the Dream Team would beat the current USA Olympic team.
And you're a little older than me. So I remember the Dream Team. But weren't a lot of these guys on kind of the tail end of their career a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even just the idea. So there's footage of these epic Dream Team scrimmages where they would play each other. And so you just watch this footage and they don't move like players today. They don't move like them. Speed, power, like even their ball handling, they're playing inside the arc. I mean, who is the best shooter on the Dream Team? I mean, there's just like the lack of shooting.
I'll answer that question. I guess would it be Larry Bird?
Maybe, but here's the thing with Larry Bird in shooting. He was not a prolific three-point shooter. Right. I think he averaged, and you know, someone checked me on this, but the last time I looked, he averaged 1.8 3-point field goals per game throughout his career. Not so, like, he did most of his work from the mid-range. So even though he was a good shooter, he was not a prolific 3-point shooter. Who was on that team? You know, nobody.
Yeah, can't think of one. And yeah, we were just shooting so far less threes. And I feel like people our age, we think of like the 90s or early 2000s, like, gosh, that was like yesterday. Mm-hmm. It's like comparing players in the 60s to players in the 90s. They're just, the game's completely different. There is no comparison. And here we are 30 years later. So
30 years later. Yeah,
it's crazy.
It's crazy.
All right, let's go to the mailbag here. I'm going to lead you off with, I'm going to tee one up for you. I'll give you a fastball right down the middle here.
Ooh.
Explain the deny position in lock left. If players face the ball, they lose their man because they can't see them. Am I missing something? Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I would say this is probably where coaches are the most reluctant to adopt this idea. And yet, I think it's one of the most powerful, excuse me.
Bless you.
Thank you. I think it's one of the most powerful adjustments that one can make to their defense. So we teach, traditional deny is not something that we teach in the lock left defense. Instead, we actually rename it and use a completely different word. The word we use is snipe. So we don't have a deny position. We have a snipe position. And position is not a role. Position is a body position. When you're one pass away to the right as the offense is looking at it, or one pass away from jail, you want to snipe. And so snipe is the outcome that we want. So regardless of technique or body position, we want to snipe or hunt the pass. If a pass is made, we want to make an attempt to steal it. We're not going to be 100% successful, but that's the one question, yes or no. Did you do your job, yes or no? Did you hunt the pass, yes or no? And so the verbal reminder that we'd be giving from the bench, training and practice, is snipe, 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 mark, snipe, mark, snipe. So if the goal is to actually steal the pass, the goal is not to deny or disallow the pass. What's the most efficient way to do that with your body position and technique? And so if we think of trying to intercept any sort of a throw, like even in football, right? Well, in football, if you can, the best way to snipe and shoot the gap is you're going to run through the gap, get between the ball and the receiver, and grab it with your chest facing the target, the ball. So that's what we're attempting to do there. Now, obviously, sometimes in football, and of course, I know very little about football, but I have seen this. Sometimes you get turned around and you attempt to bat the ball away. But that is when you're disadvantaged. When you have any sort of an advantage in football and you can anticipate and read it, you're going chest to ball. Now, when you go chest to ball, you are aware of where the receiver is. You've seen the receiver the entire defensive possession. You then anticipate and predict the pass and go and snipe or steal the pass. That's the same thing that we're attempting to do from the snipe position. And so if I am in a snipe position and we're locking the ball to jail, which is that way, and I'm one pass away to the right, which is this way, and the player that I am responsible for and defending is above me, and the ball is this way, instead of traditional deny, which is going to be here, I'm then looking to snipe. And so the three things that are really different are, one, we are not on the line, up the line in the snipe position, where in traditional deny, you are on the line of the pass, up the line towards the ball. We are not that way in the snipe position. Instead, we are actually below the line and below our player. We are below the line and below our player. So the player that I'm sniping is actually going to be above me right here. So I'm below the player. and I'm actually going to be below the line of the pass, not on the line of the pass. So that's one. That right there is going to fix your problem of, oh, we're losing our player and we can't see them. You can't see them because you're standing in the wrong spot. Okay. So then the second thing is, instead of discouraging the pass, we're inviting the pass. We're inviting this. We're close enough to our player, so we're not in the gap and, you know, we're not staying back. We're close enough to our player that we can make an attempt on the ball. But in the lock left, we hunt passes and not dribbles, which also will help with your foul control. Every time we go and try to steal a dribble as an on-ball defender, every time we try to go steal a dribble as an off-ball defender, we say, no, we're not hunting dribbles. We're not helping on dribbles. We're hunting passes. So we're anticipating and we're going to try to make an attempt on the pass. That'd be the second thing. And then the third thing is we switch everything. So if there is some sort of an exchange that I'm involved in as a defender, or if there's some sort of screen or cut, our goal would be to switch everything so that the sniper, the person sniping that pass, can stay the sniper and get better at reading and anticipating those patterns. If we can stay on script, meaning we script what the defensive possession looks like, we script the ball going to jail, we script sniping the pass, we script getting our best rim protector on the wall. If we can stay on script, then we're going to get similar patterns for similar people more often and improve faster. And so having your sniper sniping more often allows you to write the script and stay on book a little bit more.
Yeah. Love the detail in the answer. And as you're talking about this, I start thinking of the way I've coached. I have coached traditional online upline, chin on shoulder, so you can see ball and man. Mm-hmm. The problem is it's really tough to see ball and man doing that, especially on a back cut where you have to snap your head and find the ball. As I'm teaching that to my teams, as I'm going through that, I even went through this thought process years ago, and I started asking my assistants, like, why don't we just turn the other way and accomplish the same thing? We can still challenge passes or snipe passes, but we have better vision of the ball. And if I was going to lose sight of one momentarily, it'd probably be my man rather than the ball, because we're always adjusting to the ball. One of the hardest things on defense, I think it's easy to teach our position on ball. It's easy to teach our position off the ball. What's difficult is your responsibility as the ball moves. So I'm guarding this action on the weak side and the ball is driven. Well, that's really difficult. So let's always have sight of the ball. Another common pushback we might get from coaches would be, well, aren't we going to get back cut? Like you said, we can switch that back cut so we can stay in our roles and not be occupied by offensive movement. But back cutting is a sign of disruption. So if we're back cutting, they're not getting catches where they want them. It means we're applying pressure, and a back cut is a pressure release more than it is a scoring play. Do we love to score off a back cut? Is it pretty? Absolutely. But I would say you score on 10% of back cuts, maybe. And so I'll end with this. The thought process I was going through was absorbed beliefs and chosen beliefs. Traditional deny is an absorbed belief. I do it this way because that's the way I see it done. That's how all my coaching friends and mentors have taught it before. What I admire about you and what we are about at Savvy Coaching is we challenge traditional thinking and search for better ways to do something. So this would be a chosen belief rather than an absorbed belief, right? We choose to deny this way because we think it's better.
Yeah. And I fully support coaches that want to go traditional deny. Just know why. So begin with the end in mind. What's the outcome you want? And then build from there with, okay, well, how can we create that outcome? I've chosen some outcomes that we want in the lock left defense and built with the end in mind. Decide the outcome you want with your defense and then build backwards from there, as opposed to say, we just do this thing because I've seen this thing and I like this thing, or I'm comfortable with this thing. And like, interestingly enough, and I didn't even know this until someone sent it to me, John Calipari has been teaching one pass away defense this way forever. I saw an old clip. I can't remember what player he had, but they were in very short shorts and he was doing a clinic in like the, I want to say the, like the 80s or something, or the early 90s. And he was teaching defense this way. So it's not a new thought, but I think we've arrived at it separately.
Yeah. Really good. All right, let's shift offense. And I'll ask myself this question. I'll go first on this. And then you can piggyback. So first year coach teaching dribble drive motion. And he's having trouble with a point guard that over dribbles. So he's constantly going sideways and not downhill. His question was, what are some things that we can do to get the ball out of my point guard's hands and get the offense started? I'll say, if you are a point guard or what we would call a racker, your job is to initiate offense. That could be with a hunt in transition with pace. It sounds like their racker is doing this too much, so that's okay. I would say I don't like to run just dribble drive as a main offense. Do we borrow some of those concepts in race and space or drive and space? Absolutely. But I think that's the biggest hiccup with dribble drive offense is your racker, your point guard is ball dominant. Everybody else is just kind of standing around. We almost feel isolated from our teammates. So my advice to this coach in our community, I typed this one in and a couple other coaches chimed in as well, would be the root cause is your point guard not passing across and getting in the row series. Which would be a series that you could blend into dribble drive. And this coach has done that. So I offered a quick fix, which would be false motion or movement, where the coach could joystick and say, look, if I call this, it means we're going, you know, a DHO to start the possession. We're going to get it out of his hands that way. But I encouraged him to fix the root cause in that your point guard is missing the trigger for row series. They're driving neutral instead of creating an advantage with their teammates by entering in an action. Doesn't have to be row series, right? But let's get into an action when neutral instead of always driving. So I would encourage this coach, instead of just finding the Band-Aid of installing something to get the ball out of his hands, you can do that for the short term. But the long term, the better fix would be fixing the root cause of let's recognize a trigger or recognize neutral and get into a trigger to create an advantage.
Yeah. And again, zooming out, why are they over dribbling? It's because they don't yet understand neutral and advantage. They don't recognize it yet. Or they don't know what to do with those two scenarios. So they're dribbling in neutral, which is a very, very common error. It's one that is probably one of the most taught aspects of the game with all the players that I get to work with on a weekly basis. We were working on it last night again, and it's a continuous thing. You know, I'll also ask you this one, Mark. When trying to decide who's going to be your primary ball handler, what we call a racker, we call them a racker because they need to be able to break the shell, get to the rack, and create advantage for our offense. And oftentimes, them creating advantage does not mean creating a shot for themselves. They're trying to, they're just trying to create an advantage. You do that by getting the ball near the rack because that compromises defense. We all understand this. So that's why we call it a racker instead of a point guard. Point guards traditionally, as we understand them, it's why we've changed the name, is they get up and run an offense is what point guards do, right? Which is the opposite error of what is being asked about here, which is they don't even look to go and create an advantage in the chaos of transition. They just go and run the script. So there's errors on both sides. And as you is usually the case, the sweet spot is in a narrow, narrow compromise in the middle and be able to recognize the difference. So that's why we call it a racker. All right, Mark, I'm going to describe two players on your team, and you have to determine which one is going to be your racker. Because a lot of times it's very, very hard to make significant changes in a player's IQ, awareness, and skill set in a short period of time. The greatest ability, our greatest impact as a coach to impact the way our team plays on the floor is who we put in what seats on the bus, who we put in what roles. If you want your team to play this way, then utilize a player's strengths and hide their weaknesses in this way, as opposed to trying to change what that player is. That player's not going to change very much over a short period of time, and they'll change a little over a long period of time. So who you decide to put in different seats on the bus will determine what your team play looks like. And that's really your power and impact as a coach. All right, here's your two racket types. One player is incredibly athletic and dynamic. They're your fastest player with the ball in their hands, and your best finisher at the rim. They can finish against contact, and they put terror into the hearts of the opponents when they're playing downhill. That
enough player, about me, Tyler. Talk about the next player.
Talk about me. Those are their strengths. Their weaknesses are they have no clue what the difference between advantage and neutral is. They only see red, and they go. Which might be similar to the player that this coach is talking about. And this player takes a ton of fives, and once they break the shell, a shot is going up. They never get off the ball. They either shoot it or turn it over. The only time they'll pass it is if they're falling over, and then they'll just huck a pass off because they can't shoot it anymore. Okay, that's player number one. Player number two plays with really good pace, strong ball handler, does recognize the difference between advantage and neutral. Smaller player, not a great finisher at the rim because of their height. A really good shooter off the catch, especially. Really good passer. Once they crack the shell, more likely to pass than to shoot, but not drawing a lot of help. Who do you choose as your racker out of those two players?
So this second player is not drawing a lot of help.
Not drawing a lot of help, drawing a little bit, but just because they're not as much of a finisher, when they break the shell, you can see it even in their body. They're going into pass mode a little bit more. They're not hunting to score as much. They will if it's wide open.
Okay. God, this is a tough one. Initially, I was falling in love with this first player until you said takes a lot of fives when they crack the shell. A shot is typically going up. They pass as a last resort. I don't like the fact that player two does not draw a lot of help, because I was falling in love with this player too. I think they both can add a ton of value, right? I would have to pick, gosh, this is tough.
It's hard, right?
I want the most athletic player with the ball getting downhill. However, I'll make my answer this way. Racker would be player two. Especially since I'm a big proponent, believer of Rose series, where we're throwing across the top a lot, where your dragon or your trail is going to get a lot of opportunity. I don't think you miss a lot with the first player serving as your dragon. I might even make those two players. Oh, I'll straddle here. You could make those two players interchangeable, and closest player of the ball inbounds, other one is the racker for that possession. That way you get a little bit of the best of both worlds. But if I had to pick, I would go player two, because if that player can get us in the dominoes, he or she is creating an advantage, which we can expand into a nine or a seven. I feel like the first player is going to cause a lot of frustration to the staff and the team if we're taking bad shots. A bad shot is often the outlet pass for the defense. It's like a turnover. That would be my justification for picking player two. Although my KPI for the first player, my key performance indicator, what I would focus a ton on their skill development with, would obviously be decision making and shot selection.
No.
How about you? Yeah. Who's your pick?
I have those two players. I have those two players, and I have chosen the same. I've made player number two our starting racker, and they probably play 2/3 of the game at the racker position, and the other 1/3 of the game, player one is the racker. But I really like starting the game without giving the other team outlets because of poor shot selection. Yeah. And that's worked out really well for us.
Yeah. I think too, you know, most of the time when you run an action, let's call it a ball screen, how many times is the player with the ball score off a ball screen?
If usually, you're a good team, least.
Right. Yeah. So usually it's, you know, maybe the role man, but usually it's the three players off the ball, right? Mm-hmm. Like the three amigos that are spacing the floor. Mm-hmm. They're usually the benefactor. So I think a key skill for the Raptor is being able to understand, is this play for me or my teammates? So really, really selfish in creating advantages, really, really unselfish in how that fits in with team concepts and playing with their teammates.
Yeah. And so agreed. And so if we bring this thing full circle to the question about, I have this point guard that's dribbling around too much, I would say maybe they're in the wrong role. That's another thing as well, is there might be someone that you could put in that role that just doesn't do that as much.
Yeah. And that's honestly probably the easiest fix or the quickest fix, right? Is just change role. All right. Let's go to game of the week here.
Could you do one more question while I pull up the video for this?
Yeah, let's do this one. So how do we focus, or how much do you focus on attacking specific matchups? The example, my good friend JT asked in the chat, was if there's a big, I want to get into the action, the next dead ball, do we go to spread ball screen to attack them in the post? He was kind of experimenting this with Summer League. My thought process is the goal of offense is to find the big advantage. If that advantage is the matchup, if the biggest advantage is the matchup, then let's absolutely use it. And I think that's what we see in the NBA, is one of the best players in the world playing one-on-one in space is a pretty big advantage, right? Like, how hard is it to stop KD or LeBron or Steph Curry in space? Really, really difficult. I think sometimes we get infatuated with a mismatch, and if it's not something that we practice, it can take away from the pace in which we run our offense, and we try to force feed that player. I have seen that gone south more times than it's worked at lower levels. So if it's not something that you practice, I do think, you know, concept from the Golden State Warriors is one way they attack the switch is they say it's just going to play out in the wash. If we have an advantageous matchup, if we continue to run our stuff, we'll likely find that advantage, and it'll kind of take care of itself rather than force feeding.
It's good. I'm ready.
All right. Let's go game of the week. Tyler's going to share one from Lock Left, 1v1 Lock.
1v1 Lock. So the intent of 1v1 Lock, and Mark, you can see my video here.
Yep.
The intent of 1v1 Lock is actually to identify and improve how our Wolves primarily, but any player, would defend the ball in space far away from the rim, and with the attempt to influence the ball to one side of the floor, for us, the left-hand side of the floor, so that we can then keep the ball on the left-hand side of the floor throughout the possession. So this is not how we're necessarily guarding the ball in the read zone or in the half court or inside the three-point line. This is how we want to try to pick up and influence the ball early. So there's three main outcomes that we want here. One, don't get beat. Two, do not foul. Three, get the ball crossing half court on the left-hand side. What we found is the more often we can get the ball to cross the court on the left-hand side, and our KPI for that is, can 70% of the opponent's possessions can the ball cross half court on the left-hand side, the left-hand lane of the street, if there's two sides of the street. That's like your first KPI when you know that you're doing this well. So we do 1v1 Lock in this way. So here's the organization. You can kind of see it here is we actually put a line, a row of players. I like doing this with anywhere from four to six players in a group. We put a row of players on this lane line. They actually become the out of bounds line. So the lane line's out of bounds. We have them standing here to keep it out of bounds, and the sideline's out of bounds. The offense wins, and the offense gets a point. I play this one for time. And then we see who has the most points. Offense gets a point if they can cross half court line with an attacking dribble in their right hand. Defense gets a point, as we see this defender here. Defense gets a point if they cross half court with the ball in their left hand. And defense also gets a point if they don't cross half court. Defense gets a point for a steal. Defense gets a point if it goes out of bounds. And I'll add this one. It doesn't happen very often. Defense gets 3 points if they take a charge. Because the offense is so bullish and aggressive to get to their right hand, there are many opportunities where you can actually just square up and take an on-ball charge, which actually happens in real games as well, especially under pressure when players want to get to their right hand. The rotation you'll see right here. So you'll see that this really teaches players, it moves players from their traditional habit of squaring the ball up and stopping the ball from being dribbled north-south to instead keeping a reactionary gap, influencing the ball left and running alongside like a wolf would, running alongside the ball to get it to go right. The offense is really trying to go right, right? And the defense is not allowing them to go right. Offense doesn't want to cross half court. That is what lock left looks like in the full court. And there's that battle. Possession ends and we get the rotation. Okay. Rotation is offense. It's sprinting while the ball clicks down the line, sprinting all the way back down to get on the ball. And now they are locking. Okay. They're working on to keep that reactionary gap. That would be another point for the defense. And then we rotate again. Right. This is teaching without us spending a lot of time on technique. It's teaching how we actually want to play on the ball, which is we want to play nose outside of the right shoulder. We want to keep a reactionary gap, ready to sit on that right hand. Offense is trying to get right. Defense, not letting, so defense would have won that possession as well. We'll see one more possession here. And I think it's good for a lot of coaches to actually see what this on-ball sort of stance looks like. You'll notice too, like a lot of people think, oh, lock left is means we're pressing and we're pressuring them at all times. Maybe really first step is just influencing. You'll see like there's a reactionary gap here. There's not turning. We're not making plays on the ball. We're not trying to steal the ball. We're trying to steal passes, right? Every time they try to go right, that's what it means to sit on the right hand. Is you'll wall up and get physical, get into bumper cars. Bumper cars is forearm across the body. You'll bumper car whenever they try to go right. Good. That'd be another point for the defense. And, you know, you're seeing how enthusiastic the offense is there attempting to get to their right hand. And so we're creating that here by giving the offense a point if they can get to their right hand and beat them right. But that's actually what it looks like in real games. Players want to get to the right hand that badly. So it really does, I have found, imitate what a game-like situation is. What questions do you think are worth asking about that, Mark?
I'm glad you asked because I do have a question.
Yeah.
Number one, don't get beat. Number two, don't foul. Number three, let's get it crossing on the left side. Mm-hmm. Let's say I'm an early adopter of lock left, or I'm early in my process of installing, and mm-hmm. I just want to give my team one KPI. So we're going to play a summer league game, or it's day one of install, and I could only give my players one of those three. Where would you start?
Get it to cross on the left side.
Because even if you get beat, you got help behind you.
Exactly.
And yeah.
So I probably said them in the wrong order. So yeah, if I had to put those in order, would be get it to cross half court on the left-hand side, don't get beat, and third would be don't foul. Once you're doing one, work on two. Once you're doing two, work on three.
Yeah. I like that.
Because if you are going to be closer to the ball sooner in the lock left defense than most traditional defenses. We're attempting to pick up the ball as early as the wolf can on makes and misses. And so it could look like a full-time pressing defense on makes and misses to the untrained eye, because we want to try to influence the ball left as early as possible, which in turn, when we do influence it left early for most players, that actually slows the ball down, which is what we want to do in transition on misses and turnovers anyway. And so we want to slow the ball down without trying to turn the ball. And so that's why it would influence. So when we pick up early and more often, we're going to spend more minutes of the clock in close proximity to the ball, which can result in more fouls over the long term. And so that's why that third one of don't foul is in there.
Yeah. I'll also say this. That is a great ball handling drill, right?
Great.
Ball handling is getting to your spot with the ball. We saw a lot of turnovers, a little messy, but that's a good thing. That's, and it also goes back to our racker versus point guard, right? So racker, maybe our first player in our scenario earlier might be, I'm going to put my head down, full head of steam, mm-hmm. a point guard might be, I'm going to get to my spot and initiate offense. And again, we want to be in that like narrow kind of best of both worlds, maybe based on situation or how the defense is playing.
Yeah.
Good. All right.
Use that one and then ask any further questions that you have. We'll be linking this one in the school community. It will be in the Lock Left course. I think it'll be in the drill book as well, Mark. So yeah, all of our grow members, or if you purchase the Lock Left course, you'll get access to that.
Yep. We'll put that in the defensive section of the drill book. We actually had somebody ask a question. I'm glad you brought that up in our community of, can we take these games of the week and the Teach Better tools that we share in the hours and put them in the classroom? Absolutely. We're already doing that. If they're not already in there, we are cutting these and we're constantly adding these into the classroom. I would encourage you to use the search feature. So if you're listening to this, search 1v1 lock or, one ball defense, and you'll be able to find it. It'll show up in the drill book, Lock Left, and anywhere it's been mentioned in the community, which is another great feature of school, being able to search. That is one reason why we have loved our transition to the school platform. All right. Our Teach Better or Practice Better tool of the week. This is more of a teaching tool, and this came up last night. So was talking to a handful of coaches, went out to dinner, and naturally we start talking ball. And I shared that coaches should move away from on-air drills. But I'll say this, nothing's wrong. I think everything is on a spectrum. So we have, one end of the spectrum, which is your block, your on air, and then you have the other end of the spectrum, which would be a games-based or constraints-led approach. Nothing's wrong. We just want to move along the spectrum, different ways to do it. I made this comparison, like sometimes in practice, we just really overload something. Like I want my offensive players to go against, four offensive players to go against six defenders so we can really simulate pressure. I would use on-air stuff in a scenario like that, like a very extreme scenario where we want to illustrate or break something down. But I would do this. I would do anything on-air after installing or introducing 5-on-5. So I have a video, if you're watching on YouTube, of us going through slow learning here. And my video is frozen. Give me one sec. So what you're going to see when I pull up this video, you're going to see us installing a concept within our offense. So we were actually installing a specific trigger here, and I wanted our players to be able to see and feel what the trigger felt like. You get that. You can teach that better with defense. How many times do we run 5-on-0 offense and we say, well, you can't make that pass there because defense will be there. That's too long of a pass. That's not going to get through. So I like 5-on-5 slow learning where we have defense out there. Offense can see where the defense will be and how we're going to play through that. So if you're watching on YouTube, which I would recommend you do if you're listening on like a podcast platform, find us on YouTube for the game of the week and the Teach Better of the week. We just had a situation where we're walking through, we stopped, and now we're going to recreate the same scenario. I find there's much more value in going really, really slow with these things, because when we talk pace on offense, that could be transition, but we're also talking about the pace in which we recognize neutral or the pace in which we recognize a specific trigger. Trigger for Rose series is ball in the action spot. Early on in the implementation process, it's going to take your players a little while to figure that out. When you're playing 5-on-0 full speed or 5-on-5 full speed, they're going to miss it. And that might be when a point guard over dribbles. When we go slow learning, you give them time for them to process and to find those triggers and play through those triggers. And then the more we do that, they will recognize those triggers quickly, which is checkpoints that we want to see and where we ultimately want to go, where there's this almost automated response where we recognize triggers or flow into certain concepts. So I would argue that it's easier to install things 5-on-5 slow than it is 5-on-0. So coaches, try 5-on-5 slow learning and give me your feedback. I'd love to hear how it went for you. You're walking through. You can stop it at any time, but again, you'll have to stop it less because your players are going to have more time to recognize what you're actually installing.
Okay, can I ask you a couple questions on this?
Yeah.
Okay, you said walking through. So I may have missed it. Are there any speed constraints? Like you said, slow learning, but are there speed constraints for the offense or defense here?
Yes. I actually would want to go below half speed. Okay. In this video right here, and it's hard to do because players are kind of conditioned to practice hard, which is why I'd want to go below half speed. I would want to go like 25% speed or game speed. So we're never training in that like half speed-ish where they don't even know what half speed feels like. So we're actually going a little bit too fast right here for my like. I think this was actually the first time we ever did slow learning. So they actually had to learn how to play slow. But yes, so less than half speed. So that way we always play at two speeds, like walkthrough and game speed, nothing in between.
Nice. Which was a point that I did want to highlight is the more you do this, the more your players will learn how to slow learn and what the intent is and to actually change their speed as well. Are there any defensive constraints? Like, are they 100% live or are they at 25% as well? Or are they just reacting to the defense? You know, a lot of times like, don't steal the pass or... Are there any constraints for the defense?
Yes. So play to our rules, right? And I would say don't steal the pass, right? So if you're sniping away from jail and lock left, let the pass go through unless we're using slow learning for something defensively, right? So here we're training more offense. So defense, play to our rules. Don't steal the pass. And then offense, you can change whether you want them to shoot or not, right? It might be just play out the possession until we say stop and there's a teaching point, or if we get an open shot here, then you can take it. But again, we're not competing. So three types of drills: teaching, training, competing. This is a training / teaching drill. So there's no competition. So I wouldn't worry about creating advantages, getting shots, because here we were just trying to install a trigger.
Nice. When you recreate a situation, do you tell them exactly where to go back to when you stop it? Or do you let them try to go to a certain point? How do you recreate quickly and efficiently?
Yeah. So if you're new to recreating, I think it's important to introduce it to players. I always said hold. I didn't coach with a whistle. So when I said hold, that meant hold the ball, hold your spot, no more passes, no more dribbles. The reason why I'd introduce it to the team beforehand is you want to get them to pause as quickly as possible when they hear hold. It'll be more efficient, but also you're at the point of interruption there. So I would, if I saw something where we need to recreate, I would yell hold. I would say, let's go back to where Tyler had the catch on the wing. So I would tell them exactly where we're going back to. I'd give them the teaching point, and then we would play from that exact spot in a script to live scenario. So if Tyler got the ball on a blast cut on the wing and we were supposed to be in a zoom and we missed that trigger, I would say, let's get Tyler the ball on the wing. We're going to get immediately in a zoom. That's the script. And then once we're in zoom, we're live and we play through there. If we recreate and go back and they mess the script up, so they still don't get it, I'm going to stop it again because apparently I didn't teach it well enough. We go through it again. Once we get through the script, we're live and we play on.
Nice. Yeah. And I think the only additional reminders that I would give would be one, name it, and two, repeat it. So like, whatever you want to do. So Mark's name is hold, right? You know, the language that I've used is two different words. We're going to do a redo. So they know that this is what we're doing. We're going to redo this. So we call those redos. We have offense and defensive redos. So they know that the redo is we're going to redo that situation or script and we need to improve something. So they get really used to a redo. Okay. So I use a whistle, not a hold, either the same thing. I whistle, say, let's get a redo. And the more I use the word redo, the more they can start to self-organize because it fits into this like terminology and vocabulary. So name what you're trying to do. Right. And then the second word that I use is, and it helps me and us get more efficient, is rewind. Okay. Pause. Okay. Rewind. And so what I've used is like everyone watches, they stream shows or watch YouTube, and nearly every player that all of these young people use now has like the forward and the back little circle arrows. Right. And so I say, hey, we use 5 second rewinds. It's like, I'm just tapping that 5 second rewind, get back 5 seconds. And I use that. It gets a similar thing. Everyone can use their own tools. It gets a similar thing to yours, Mark, which is like, get the ball in the wing. I say, give me a 5 second rewind. And what I found is over time, I think that helps them build a map in their mind of where they were 5 seconds ago. And I think that there's value to that instead of over scripting. Okay, I want Tyler in the corner. Layla, you're on the porch, right? Just every 5 second rewind. Right. And then we can adjust from there. But I think it gets their focus from, which I think we want. Most players play with like a narrow direct and first person shooter focus. That's all they see, with very little awareness of where the other 9 players are on the court. Where the best players are zoomed out and they have an awareness of all 9 players on the court at all times. Right. And so I think the more we can move their focus from me to the rim to where's everyone else? I think those are good things to build in to our development.
Yeah. Reminds me of something I've said often is everybody knows how to play basketball. Very few know how to play with 9 other players on the court. So being able to see all 10 players is it's a coaching superpower, but also a playing superpower as well.
And there's a lot of good stuff in today's episode.
I know, man. Jam packed in there. So appreciate you spending this time with Tyler and I. We will see you next episode. And again, all this content will be broken up and put in Classroom. So if you're not a Grow member, sign up for Grow and you'll have access to all of this in the Classroom. As always, stay savvy and we will see you next week.
See y'all.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.